Jay Williams here. Yeah, I know. Just a bunch of church bells, eight of them, in fact, running from top to bottom in a major scale over and over. But listen to what they do now. As you can hear, the bells are no longer running a descending major scale with each cycle. Now they're doing something different. And what they're doing differently is they're playing permutations of, in this case, seven out of the eight bells. The eighth bell, which is called the tenor, it's the lowest pitched bell, stays at the end of each cycle, kind of like a drum beat. So it's the other seven bells that keeps going through permutations. The basic idea of all this being that if you have to ring for a long time, wouldn't it be better to have something that sounded more musical than just running the major scale forever, which, by the way, is called ringing at rounds. So, back about 300 some years ago, English bell ringers decided that a way of doing this so that you didn't have to repeat yourself would be to take permutations of however many bells you had. In this situation here, which, by the way, is the Episcopal Cathedral of St. James in Marietta, Georgia, we have what is called a ring of eight bells. So you could potentially have 40,000 some cycles before you repeat yourself. In the method you were hearing here, there were seven out of the eight bells that were going through permutations, so you only have 5,040 possible changes before you repeat yourself. There are some methods that do take advantage of all the permutations, but there are a lot of methods that only take advantage of a certain number of them, depending on the rules of composition that are used in preparing them. The basic rule is no bell can move more than one place at a time, which is lucky because all the ringers memorize their bell path. I haven't started doing that yet. I'm a beginning student of this stuff, and I'm still learning rope control, which is a matter unto itself. And how I'm going to memorize any of these really extensive bell paths is still a little beyond me, even though I'm used to memorizing things. But I take some comfort in the idea that all these other ringers are standing there, they've memorized this stuff, so I suppose I can do this. To get back to what you've just heard, the first change that happened was that the bell that's in third place, and it happens to be number three at the beginning here because it was ringing consecutive notes in the major scale, so the number three bell was in thirds place. That stayed in the same place, but the other pairs crossed, so it went 2, 1, 3, 5, 4, 7, 6, 8. Now the next change that came around, the bell that was in first place, which happened to be bell number two, it stayed there. And all the other ones crossed. So it went 2, 3, 1, 4, 5, 6, 7. So all those others crossed, and you got something that sounded kind of like it did at the beginning, only there's that funny thing up at the top, the way it began. And so on. You keep alternating between which bell stays in the same place and which ones cross. So depending on which bells stay in the same place and which ones cross with each cycle, you can make more and less complicated changes. The reason you hear organ music somewhere in the background is because this bit of ringing was done at the end of a funeral during the last verse of one of the hymns. It's kind of the change ringing equivalent of the second line in a New Orleans funeral. So you ring the soul on its way out. That was recorded in the ringing room, and the trap door up to the belfry was open so that we could hear the bells clearly over the sound of the organ. The door to the ringing room is left open so that people can walk by and watch the ringing process go on. Before I describe the process, you might wonder how I happened to get into something like this. Well, when I was much younger, I read a murder mystery story called The Nine Tailors by Dorothy L. Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S. It was written in the mid-1930s, and it is far and away the best murder mystery ever written. It makes Sherlock Holmes look pale. It makes everything else look pale. It is so amazing. And not only is the story itself a remarkably original story, but part of what makes it original is the degree to which she includes the process of change ringing as part of the story. I recommend it very, very highly. Speaking of which process, let's describe that. In the ringing room, what you find are 8 ropes hanging down in a circle. 8 ropes in this situation. There are ringing rooms with as many as 12. A couple over in England have 20. But this one has a sane 8. So it's a fairly small room, but with a very high ceiling, about a 12-foot ceiling, which takes on great importance as we go on with this description. Each rope ends in a long loop, which, if just lying there, part of it will be lying on the floor. And then at about chest level, the rope has woven into it a thing called a sally. It's a fluffy material about 2 inches in diameter, and it's a couple feet long. And this sally is specifically there to be easily grabbed. By the way, the rope itself has a diameter of about 3/8 of an inch, and it goes all the way up through the ceiling through a hole with pulleys in it so it doesn't have friction there, and then around a big wheel that operates the bell. Now, the bell is mounted on its own frame, and it's mounted from the center of the very top of the dome of the bell so that all the vibrating surfaces are free to vibrate. Each bell has a clapper, and on one side of the frame is a big wheel around which the rope goes, and the wheel has flanges. It's like a giant pulley wheel. It's a little larger in diameter than the bell is. And the rope comes up through that ceiling from the ringing room and goes through a hole in the side of the wheel. Not from the bottom, because if it came through the bottom, then you couldn't pull the rope and make the bell do anything. So it has to be somewhere on the side to get the bell moving. Try to imagine getting a bell to ring on cue when it's hanging down. So you start pulling the rope, and I mean, these bells are heavy. The lowest one in this particular ring is around 600 pounds, and that's not particularly heavy as these things go. So you want to get this bell to ring just after another guy's bell rings. So you start pulling the rope, and you pull and pull, and finally it goes far enough to where it goes bong. So how to get the bell to ring on cue? Well, remember that the bell frame has a wheel on it and a rope going around it. This means that the bell can swing through a complete circle, 360 degrees, in either direction. And it turns out the bong happens just before the bell reaches its balance point, with its mouth up. And the real trick is to start the bell moving in the opposite direction, either right at the balance point or just before the balance point, depending on whether you come sooner or later in the next cycle. And you have to be able to control the bell such that you're right on time. In my class the other day, we were actually trying that with me on the bell to see how I would do, and it turned out that I was the 4th bell in that particular sequence, and I had to pull the rope off balance just about when I heard the sound of bell number 1. So not only do you have to remember the cycle of changes as it goes along, but you have to also think in advance how many bells ahead you have to pull that rope to get your bell to ring at the proper point in the cycle. I'm not quite sure yet how I'm going to really manage that, but other people have done it. Most sighted people are watching the ropes move, and so they can see when the rope just before or after theirs moves and judge accordingly. But my teacher and one of my backup ringers insist that they hardly ever look at the ropes, that they're basically casting their eyes down to the floor and going by feel and sound. So, okay, we'll see. Now, another interesting point is that when you stop a ring or start one, you need some way of keeping the bell at rest with its mouth up. So what happens is, think of the bell with its mouth up. Just above the bell, there's a slider that at one end of the frame is pivoted, and at the other end, just across the diameter of the bell and a little beyond that, it slides through a groove on the other side of the frame, so it can pivot. And the end of that slider sticks out, and as the bell goes over the balance point, it tilts and comes to rest against a big piece of wood sticking up called a stay. And so you can just leave the bell sitting there until it's time to ring. And they say, look to, and that means get ready to pull the bell off balance. And they say, treble going, and that means give just enough pull on the rope to get the bell right at the balance point. Treble gone means that the bell is now moving. And given the speed of which things happen, it takes a significant time to pull the bell actually off the stay through the balance point and then on down. So when you actually start ringing the change, you want your bell to be right at the balance point or very close to it. The danger here is if you apply too much force or don't check the bell's progress, it can go over there with full tilt and break the stay. And that is surprising. That did happen to me, and I had my hands on the rope, and I wasn't expecting anything to happen quite there. And that rope took off, and I got rope burns on my fingers by the time they said, let go. And I'm kind of going, huh? By that time, my hands hurt. They say that every novice breaks a stay every now and then, and so they have spares around. So they replaced it. So now I have this souvenir of my inadequacy at rope control. The guy who's teaching me is an Englishman who's been doing this since he was 10, and he's now 75. And he's taught many, many people how to ring and thought that teaching a blind person to do this would be a really interesting challenge. I'm fortunate in being both a musician and a person who's done a lot of mechanical things. But I'll tell you, learning to control this rope, it takes a lot of practice. As I say, when you pull the bell off balance, you're holding the sally, and you have to pull it down just to the point where it wants to start rising again. And you have to ease off of that and quickly grab the tail of the rope and go way down and aim, keep the rope vertical so that when the rope comes up again, it'll tell your hands that that's what's happening, and you have to follow the rope up all the way to the end, which is about 4 feet now, and then check the rope at the balance up there again and pull down just enough to put some energy into it, and then you have to suddenly reach up and catch the sally at about chest height and follow it up until it reaches its balance point and then start the cycle over again. Especially on the end of the hand stroke going up toward backstroke, the rope is moving about 4 feet. But that's not a constant speed because the bell is accelerating and decelerating. So there's a point where it's really moving at quite an alarming speed. And it takes a while to get to where you can run that rope coolly. And it's absolutely necessary, especially for a blind person, to keep the rope vertical. There's so many things that when we move our arms, we tend to move outward or to the side. But no, here you have to aim the rope down as if you're aiming it for a hole in the floor. It reminds me that I kind of wished I had done a lot more basketball dribbling as a kid and got used to that. Because if you don't move the rope vertically, then it's apt to swing out in whatever direction it can, because there's 12 feet of rope between you and the ceiling, so there's a lot of rope that can wiggle around. And if you don't know where the sally is, then the rope is going to go on up and you'll break a stay, or anyway, you won't know what you're doing. And that's why we have the backup ringer there while I'm learning, to be the safety person to catch the bell when I don't know what's happening. And so you have to get good enough at this so that when you're actually ringing, nobody has to worry about backing you up in case you lose control, because you can't afford to lose control. So that's what I'm learning presently, is learning to control the rope. You know, a sighted person, if they get the rope wiggling someplace, they can see where it's going and they can compensate better than I can. There have been some circumstances, though, where I have made some amazing sally catches with one hand and kept control of the rope. Okay, let's actually get into the sounds of the thing. I'm going to play a recording of a bell being rung up. As I say, it starts with the bell hanging down, its mouth down. You start pulling the rope and get the bell to swing wider and wider and wider until finally it goes with its mouth up, not only to the balance point, but over, so that the slider on the bottom of the frame, which is now at the top of the frame, you might say, till that slider runs against the stay and the bell can rest there. Now, we're conversing while this is going on, so try to step outside the conversation and just listen to the sound of the bell as it goes slower and slower. Also listen for the change of sound as the bell gets closer and closer to the balance. You can hear the clapper rattling against the side of the bell. That's okay. It sounds wrong at first, but the fact is when your ringing changes, you're kind of glad this happens, because otherwise it really would be a mishmash of noise because the bells would sustain for so long. In fact, before I understood that's what was happening and I'd just hear change ringing, I kept wondering how they keep the clappers from rattling against the side of the bell. And nobody seemed to understand my question, and I couldn't understand why nobody understood my question until I began doing this and I realized that, in fact, the clappers do rattle against the side of the bell.
Like a ball that would step on it.
Uh-huh.
Can't.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
It's one thing to be familiar. It is another to actually learn.
That's it. Every second and a half, you've got to decide where am I going to go next. And as you do that, you've got to be deciding where do I go next.
Yeah.
Do I go stay where I am, or...
If you listen to that sound carefully, you'll notice that as the bell approaches the balance, the clapper rattles against the side for a longer time until the bell is pretty much muted into silence. In fact, it is. And it's not really a very pleasant sound as bell sounds go. And in the next example of ringing noises that you hear, the same thing happens, because what I'm doing is just trying to get the bell all the way up to the balance point and hold it there as long as I want to, and then pull it off balance again and swing it around the other direction and hold it at balance again. So again, the clapper mutes the bell into complete silence. In real change ringing, the bell never stays up at the balance point long enough for that to happen. The bell is muted some, but not all the way. In fact, the trickiest part of this skill is to control the speed of the bell either at or near the balance point, because you have three choices. In the next change, you're either going to be ringing at exactly the same point in the row that you did before, or you're going to ring one bell later or one bell sooner. And of course, the best control that you're going to have is at the point where the bell is moving the slowest, which means very near the balance point. One of the skills we have to develop in learning this is that as you speed up the ringing, because you're progressing toward the front of the line, you might say, you have to hold the bell up at balance for a shorter and shorter time. In fact, the bell may not reach balance. You have to slow it down, but never stop its motion. This is a rather tricky thing to do, but you can learn to feel this. So what you're going to hear next is my practice on the rope, and I'm intentionally pulling the bell all the way up to the balance point and holding it there, and then pulling it off balance again, making it swing around and hold it at balance the next circle. And I'm trying to keep it from bouncing off of the stay. In other words, I'm trying not to let it go over the balance and have the thing bang against the stay. Any one bang against the stay is probably not bad, but repeated bangs on the stay will cause wood fatigue. And one of those days, when it bangs against the stay, you will get the surprise. So here's a bit of my practice ringing the bell. A few million rope pulls later, we all decided that I was capable of ringing the bell without a backup ringer always standing there ready to recover my mistakes and keep the bell from destroying either the stay or me, that I was capable of recovering the rope and keep going. So the next step is to see if I can ring in rhythm along with a computer. There's a computer program called A-Bell, which simulates about everything that can be simulated in the art of change ringing. And so we set it up to ring rounds on six bells. So it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I'm bell number 4. And the object is to see if I can ring my bell at the same time the computer rings its number 4 bell. In order to do that, I have to actually start pulling my rope, it turns out, about 3 bells ahead, which means when I hear the sound of bell number 1, I have to pull my rope in order to get my bell to ring at the 4th place. So remember now, in terms of memorizing these changes, you have to think in terms of not only where you are from one row to another, but you have to remember to pull your bell a certain distance ahead depending on how many bells there are in that particular set of changes. So if it's a set of changes on 8 bells, that's going to be different than on a set of 6 bells. So that's another skill of memory that we're going to have to deal with. But one thing at a time. Right now we're just dealing with pulling the rope and trying to stay in rhythm with the computer. And as you'll see, I haven't mastered this completely, but I'm getting there.
Look, two, trouble's going, trouble's gone.
Good.
And finally, a ringing demonstration that both encouraged and inspired me. About a month ago, ringers came from all over the United States and England to participate in a sort of ringing convention involving practice of a set of methods called surprises. And evidently there are a lot of surprises here. These methods aren't rung that much, which is why everybody came, because they wanted an opportunity to work with these methods. And as you will hear, the first attempt of this method called Bristol Surprise ended up in quite a wonderful train wreck, and these are ringers who are really very experienced. So first I'll play you a bit of the train wreck that happened on their first go, and then I'll finish up with their fourth try at it, which sounded much more like a ringing method ought to sound. By the way, I also notice that the higher bells aren't so audible as the lower ones, and that may be because of where I was in the ringing room, or just the fact that the bigger bells are bigger bells. But anyway, I do notice that. So now here is Bristol's surprise rung on the fourth try by people who really know what they're doing. And I'm not playing all of it, just enough to give you an idea of the sort of musicality of some of those changes.
Trouble's going, it's gone. Oh, Bristol.
Thus concludes my report on my progress as a student of change ringing. I've been taking these classes since the middle of January, and this is now the end of March, and if and as further developments take place, I'll make another podcast. And I hope you've enjoyed listening to it, and also hope that maybe some of you get inspired to take up this yourself. Thanks for listening.